Drifting out of the depths of inner space floats Major Tom on a doomed mission from which he'll never return.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
David Bowie, who may ultimately be the great imitator rather than the great innovator, floats face down on the sky of 70s glam rock, pansexuality, and androgyny as the inscrutable Ziggy Stardust in this classic track. While I'm not the biggest Bowie fan, I do admire his ability to reinvent himself as the fashions change every few years, staying not quite ahead of the curve, but close enough behind the breaking swell to be washed ashore in the wake of the next big thing. Folk, glam, rock, punk, drum and bass, he has the remarkable Teflon ability to seem less like an opportunist than he probably really is. A frightfully fashionable cultural chameleon, he knows who to hang with when and could be found in the center of many of the coolest music scenes on both sides of the pond for over 30 years now. This song, written and recorded to coincide with the first moonwalk, has long been recognized as being not about some brave space cadet spinning obliviously out of control as his small capsule flies helplessly towards the sun, but about some rather ordinary individual drifting hopelessly out of reach in the quicksand grasp of a heroin overdose. The song is so evocative and such a touchstone that it has created its own small musical cottage industry. I think it's in no small part due to this song and his Ziggy Stardust persona and striking looks that Bowie got the lead role as a space alien in Nicholas Roeg's quirky 1976 film The Man Who Fell to Earth. Ten years after recording Space Oddity, Bowie released Ashes to Ashes, singing,
Ashes to ash and funk to funk it. We know Major Tom's a junkie, strung out in heaven's high, hitting an all-time low.
An And a few years after that, a virtually unknown German musician named Peter Schilling hit the charts with his dance track, Major Tom, Coming Home.
Computer has the evidence, no need to abort. The countdown starts. Watching in a trance, the crew is certain, nothing left to chance. All is working, trying to relax. Up in the capsule, sent me up a drink. Jokes, Major Tom. The count goes on.
4, 3, 2.
Despite its lush beauty, there is a tragic and ominous element to the song, with its severe stereophonic gymnastics, definitely a headphone track, and its beautifully artificial mellotron string beds. The, for the time, obligatory psychedelic freak-out ending and exotic instrumentation helped to contribute to the trippy track's nod to the pleasures of drug-induced synesthesia, while insincerely warning of the dangers of exploring inner space. Like all of Bowie's excursions, others had been there, done that, and done it better, but he's always been a master at judging the zeitgeist and remaining curiously both of the time and above it. Some of Bowie's most interesting work was done soon after he abandoned his popular Ziggy Stardust glam rock persona and joined together with producer Brian Eno, who helped shepherd him through 3 albums in the mid-70s. Dark, mysterious, filled with foreboding tones and unusual musical experiments, Low and Heroes, and to a lesser degree, Lodger, pushed the envelope of the times. My favorite tracks on those discs are the instrumentals. Thick slabs of sounds swirling through alien landscapes that abandon rhythm for an extended exploration of color. With provocative titles such as Moss Garden, Weeping Wall, and Sense of Doubt, which, not coincidentally, is what Eno always accused Muzak of lacking in defense of his own ambient work. Recently, Philip Glass used these pieces as the basis for 2 large orchestral works in his inimitable, well, okay, his very imitable style, the Low Symphony and the Heroes Symphony.
Thank you.
David Bowie has evolved several personas since then, Aladdin Sane, The Thin White Duke, and so on, drifting through heavy metal and dance music and even narrating a version of Peter and the Wolf and appearing on Broadway as the Elephant Man. More recently, he's gone public, selling shares of his songs as a tradable commodity. And just to prove how terribly au courant is, one of his more recent albums was released only online. Classy, trashy, futuristic, nostalgic, Bowie is everything and nothing, a musical cipher. The male Madonna, Ziggy Zelig. And it's hard to imagine a time or a tide where that won't be the case.
I'm afraid of America. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of America. I'm afraid of the world.
Since Space Oddity is one of rock's quintessential drug songs, it's fitting that it played a part in my first experience going out of my head. I was 16 and had been a very good boy for a very long time. Living in the dorm at Interlaken, feeling my oats, I decided it was time to dip my toes in the warm waters of altered perception. Eric, my roommate, and Alan, our other best friend, had started sneaking out on the weekends to smoke pot. Simultaneously intrigued and repelled, I decided it was time I tasted the fruit of the tree of ignorance, so one day after dinner I announced that I was ready to try my hand at inebriation.
Here where I'm sitting, the sun is bright.
Ever helpful, Eric and Alan sent me off that weekend to get drunk at a mutual friend's room. I had a couple of rum and cokes, but for whatever reason, they didn't affect me, while my host had to excuse herself to sloppily throw up in her bathroom.
Because I'm high, higher than the sky. Hail any season, don't need a reason why should I try? I'm never gonna die.
The next weekend, Eric and Alan walked me out to the airport, a small, long-abandoned cottage tucked into the woods about half a mile from campus. I gingerly followed them there and shared a joint with them. Walking back, I felt perfectly fine, same as I always did, while Eric and Alan were reduced to screaming with laughter and leaping off into the woods on some mysterious commando mission. Bummed, I slunk back to my room and waited for my buddies to return. The problem, I figured, was my brain. Apparently, it had a stranglehold on reality and would not release it, no matter how I prodded it.
Because I'm high, higher than the sky. In any season, don't need a reason why should I cry?
Resigned to a life of sobriety, I thanked my buddies for trying to help me see the dark and settled back into my boringly predictable life.
Picture yourself in a boat on
the next weekend, on a bright and warm Sunday morning, Interlaken weekends are Sunday and Monday, don't ask, I heard a soft knock at the door. Eric, never much of a morning person, snored on contentedly, so I pulled myself out of bed and opened the door. And there stood Andrew, with a smile on his face and a gleam in his eye. "I hear your brain won't let you get high," he remarked, bemusedly. "That's right," I nodded. Grinning, he opened his hand, revealing a tiny little piece of paper with a cartoon character on it. I didn't recognize it at the time, but the picture was one of R. Crumb's stable of comic characters, the bearded Mr. Natural.
Lucy,
Put this in your mouth and suck on it until it dissolves, Andrew instructed. I looked skeptically at the impossibly small piece of paper and even more skeptically at Andrew. Go ahead, he urged, and took another tiny scrap of paper out of his pocket and put it on his tongue.
Flowers that grow so incredibly high.
Listen, I appreciate the thought, Andrew, but you'd just be wasting it on me. Like I said, my brain won't let me get high. And besides, that's so small, what could it possibly do? Andrew grinned and pushed his hand toward me. Go ahead, he urged. Take it and let's go for a bike ride. I shrugged, took the scrap of paper out of his palm, and set it on my tongue. Andrew grinned and nodded, then turned and walked down the hall to get to the bike racks. I quickly threw on some clothes and followed him outside, sucking on the tiny little piece of paper, which had started to get strangely slippery. Andrew was a year older than me, a senior to my junior, and, along with Eric and myself, he was a dance major. The three of us made up the entire male part of the department. He and I had become friends the year before, when we discovered a shared interest in photography and synthesizer music. He was the only person I had ever run across that also had a Synergy album. Andrew was an outrageous person, likely to say anything to anybody at any time, and his gleeful anarchy was very appealing to somebody as responsible and socially conservative as myself. Later, as we all grew to adulthood, his shameless behavior became sleazy and degrading and impossible to support or even endure. But in high school, it could be quite entertaining hearing some blushing girl yell, "Andrew!" with exasperation as he propositioned her in the cafeteria. He got slapped more than anybody I knew, but all that bashing didn't abash him one bit. After the long, cold, dreary Michigan winter, there's nothing better than a bright, warm spring day, and it was a perfect Sunday morning as we rode our bikes off campus and down Diamond Park Road, curving along the shoreline of one of the lakes, Green Lake, a lake of some personal significance, that gives Interlochen its name. It was a spectacular technicolor day, with the sun shining cheerily through a million new leaves and a gentle breeze wandering lazily through the woods. After about half an hour, we stopped at a small bridge and watched the water flow underneath us for a moment. How do you feel? Fine. The same. Okay, let's go. Andrew got back on his bike and I followed him down the road for another couple of miles. As the road swerved away from the lake, the academy visible on the other side, I began to get a strange electrical feeling in my stomach. Then I noticed that my hands were a little tingly, too. Andrew stopped and abruptly picked up his bike and carried it out into a field. Puzzled, I stopped and followed him out, although I walked my bike instead of carrying it. When I caught up with him, by a tree in the middle of the field, I asked him what was going on. Oh, I just figured that my bike is probably tired of carrying me. I thought I'd carry it for a while. For some reason, this struck me as extremely funny, and I burst out laughing as the electricity that had been swirling in my stomach overflowed and danced through my body. Andrew started laughing, and the absurdity of standing out in the middle of a field with our bikes struck me as incredibly hilarious. After a few moments of uncontrolled giggling, my sides hurt, and I was able to stop long enough to catch my breath. Now it felt like my skin had somehow come loose from my body and was floating just above it. I was in my body, but not of it. I looked down at my hands and was surprised that I had never noticed how strange they were. Not how strange my hands were, but how strange hands in general were. I was studying them in detail, turning them over, when Andrew announced that he thought we should probably get back to campus. He picked up his bike and bounced across the field, carrying it on his shoulder. I collapsed with laughter. Finally, I made it across the field and got on the bike. We started riding back towards campus, but everything was totally strange. My body seemed like some kind of machine, pumping away by itself, and I began to lose the conceptual boundaries between my body and the bicycle. I was having trouble figuring out where my hands ended and the handlebars began. Wait a minute, Andrew said as he pedaled next to me. How do you ride a bike? And then he fell over. I stopped my bike and turned around, worried that he had hurt himself. Instead, he lay on the shoulder of the road, looking up at the astonishing clouds and weeping with laughter. That sent me off, and I fell down too, gasping for air. After a minute or two, he got up and then noticed that his chain had come off. He fiddled with it for a moment and then got it back on, his hands covered with grease. I watched, fascinated, as he picked up a handful of dried leaves and rubbed them on his hands, trying to get the grease off. "Russell, Russell," he muttered as he fondled the leaves, and I knew, without the shadow of a doubt, that that was the funniest thing I had ever heard in my life. Weak with laughter, I crawled over to my bike and tried to figure out how to get back on it. Looking at the bike, I was struck with what a strange piece of machinery it was. The longer I looked at it, the stranger it seemed. By now it was clear. My brain would let me get high. I grinned and hopped on the bike, knowing full well that riding such a contraption was perfectly impossible, and trusting that my body would figure it out anyway. Even though we were clearly riding our bikes at close to the speed of sound, It took an eternity to make it back to campus. We parked our bikes, trying not to wet our pants with laughter. Now that we were back among the living, the stakes were higher, and so we had to try to pull it together. We each took a couple of deep breaths, calmed down, and strode purposefully into the dorm. Andrew turned down his hall, I turned down mine, and that was the last time I saw him that day. By now, it was around 11 o'clock in the morning, and Sunday dress dinner was coming up. Occasionally, dress dinner was a served affair, but fortunately, today it was just the regular cafeteria scene. Stand in line, get your gruel, sit down and eat it, except that the tables had paper tablecloths on them. As I walked calmly down the hall towards my room, my brain was spinning, and frankly, so was the hallway. I felt gleefully insane, but I had no idea if I looked it, so I tried to comport myself with dignity and grace. Getting to my room, I decided to see how long I could interact with Eric before he knew something was up. Using him as a litmus test was a good way to determine how strangely I was acting and what I could get away with. I took a deep breath and walked into the room. Eric had just gotten out of the shower and was standing in the bathroom, shaving. I walked quickly by the open bathroom door and into the room as coolly and normally as possible. Eric immediately came out of the bathroom, his face covered with freakish white foam. "What the hell's the matter with you?" he demanded. Oh dear, this was going to be harder to pull off than I thought. I told him what had been going on, and while a bit jealous he wasn't also involved, he was enthusiastic and curious about my experience. I tried to change into my dress clothes, but was laughing so hard that I got my legs tangled up in the pants and fell over in the closet, where I lay shrieking with laughter while Eric shook his head. Knowing that the biggest test was coming up, eating lunch in a room full of hundreds of people that knew me, some friendly, some not so much, I promised him I'd chill out, got my shoes on, and walked with him to the cafeteria. The hallway was endless, and the sound of our footsteps bounced around disconcertingly. If I looked straight ahead, it seemed like I wasn't moving at all, like I was walking on a treadmill. But if I turned my head to the side, it looked like I was running down the hall as fast as I could. I also had the strange sensation that as soon as I stopped looking at something, it disappeared, and became fascinated with my inability to prove that that wasn't the case. Concentrating mightily, I grabbed the tray and navigated the line, coming out with a Salisbury steak and some mashed potatoes. We took our usual table in the back, and I set myself to the task of eating lunch. Only I didn't really have much of an appetite, and the steak was doing this strange, bubbling, swirling thing that made it so completely disgusting that I couldn't even fathom anybody eating it ever. A big gray slab of dead animal carcass covered by viscous brown bubbling goo. No thanks. I tried the potatoes, which were agreeably soft, but the gravy was so horrifically metallic tasting and the potato flavor so overwhelming that it was like drowning in a giant vat of mashed potatoes while chewing on tinfoil. Then some girls came and sat at the table and I could no longer keep it together. I mumbled an excuse about not feeling well and practically sprinted out of the cafeteria. Oh. The truth of the matter was, I was feeling great. Too great to try and play it cool for some girls while my steak was erupting. Giggly and amazed, I found the world an endlessly fascinating place, each texture and object almost unbearably interesting. I went back to my room and pulled out Bowie's Changes One album, a greatest hits package that had been in heavy rotation in our room the past couple of weeks. First up on deck, Space Oddity.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
Although I understood the psychedelic aspects of the song before, actually being in a psychedelic headspace when hearing it was an entirely different experience.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know.
The song was breathtakingly beautiful, with its inventive production swirling around in what seemed considerably more than three dimensions. Time became fluid, expanding and contracting like the walls of my room. The song was both comfortingly familiar and horrifically alien at the same time. Seeming profound beyond reason, it struck me as perhaps the greatest and most important piece of music I had ever heard. Its mixed pro and anti-drug stance seemed startlingly relevant, and I realized, listening to the shards of sound echo through my addled brain, that I had been initiated. I had crossed a threshold. No longer a chemical virgin, I hadn't just dipped my toes into the stream of unconsciousness, I had jumped into the deepest part I could find. And triumphantly bobbed to the surface again, minutes older and years wiser. I swayed along to the disintegrating track as Major Tom floated into his own internal sun, but when the opening of John, I'm Only Dancing burst on, I pulled the needle from the record and turned the stereo off. As cool as the music was, the temporal distortions were making it hard to listen to for long, and the unbearable green outside the window was beckoning me, and I had to go outside. It couldn't have been a better day. I walked around the woods and down by the lake, marveling at every blade of grass and every flutter of wings. There were no hassles and no freakouts and no bad feelings. At one point, I had to be careful not to look down at my feet as I walked, because if I did so, the ground would rapidly telescope away from me and I'd be left dangling hundreds of feet in the air. I didn't get any great insights into the nature of reality or have any conversations with dogs, but I did have a spectacularly wonderful, infinitely green afternoon. I eventually made it back to the dorm and stopped by Andrew's room. He wasn't there, but his roommate Bob was. Bob was actually a better friend to me than Andrew was, and he was happy to see me, although he was suffering from a head cold that day. Still, he was curious about my maiden voyage and tried his best to freak me out by saying ridiculous non sequiturs and clapping loudly while he talked. It was far too obvious to work, but then I noticed something on his desk that I'd never seen before. The cafeteria used pebbled brown plastic glasses to serve drinks, and Bob had a juice glass from the cafeteria that was made out of the same material but was much smaller than the usual glasses. I had never seen one before, and it was seriously fucking with my head. With no point of reliable reference, I couldn't get a fix on how big it was, if it really was small, or if it just looked small through my distorted vision. So I picked it up, turned it around, and held it up to other things, trying to determine how big it really was. Finally, convinced, I announced, "This is small." Satisfied, I set it down on the desk and then noticed a pair of toenail clippers lying right next to it. I had never seen a pair of toenail clippers before. They were just like every pair of fingernail clippers I had ever seen, except that they were, you guessed it, much bigger. Again, I gingerly picked them up and turned them over and stared at them. Bob watched with bemusement as I held it up to the juice glass, brow furrowed in puzzlement. Finally, convinced, I announced, "This is big."
Number 9.
Bob had enough of my explorations in scale and kicked me out so he could get some sleep.
Number 9.
I went back to my room and lay on the bed.
Number 9.
The rush had passed and I was feeling calm and tired. Finally, I realized that I was back to normal. I looked at the trees out the window and noticed that if I squinted in a certain way, the branches on one of the trees clearly spelled, "Eat shit." Whoops, I guess I'm not quite done. Eric took his first trip, also a solo one, that night, and had a much different experience. Since he couldn't leave the dorm and was worried about running into an RA in his state, he spent the entire adventure in the room. I was crashing hard as he was lifting off, and all I wanted to do was go to sleep, but he was wired and talkative. He cornered me in the bathroom as I was brushing my teeth and explained his realization that smoking pot was like standing still while the world revolved around you, and taking acid was like the world stood still and you revolved around it. Anxious to get him occupied long enough for me to go to sleep, I pulled out my big book of Roger Dean paintings. He's most famous for painting the covers of early Yes albums like Tales from Topographic Oceans and Fragile, and handed it to Eric.
Number 9.
He opened it up and immediately disappeared down a rabbit hole long enough for me to get into bed. He only woke me up once, around 4 a.m, when a tickling sensation lifted me out of my slumber, and I discovered him playing with the hair in my armpit. I opened my eyes and startled him so much that he yelped and jumped across the room, cowering and babbling gibberish and laughing maniacally. In the morning, all was well, and he and I ate breakfast, sharing war stories and grinning at our new membership in the Brotherhood of Psychonauts. He and I would go on a trip together another 15 or 20 times before my emotional and psychological state got too fragile to support that kind of excursion. Some were good, some were great, but none was better than that first one, on that gloriously too green spring day, when, with the help of Mr. Natural, my brain finally relinquished its stranglehold on sobriety.
Picture yourself on a train in a station with plasticine porters, with looking glass ties.
Suddenly, someone is there at the turnstile.
A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
Lucy and the